Donald, reel number two. We were talking about the flying characteristics of the Wright biplane. Are there any other episodes with it that you recollect?
Yes, I remember people used to say, what happens if one of the chains breaks? And then Hansel would hold it into a flat spin and then she drops out of the sky. And funnily enough, we actually saw it happen. Fortunately, it happened just about 30 feet up, immediately above the Hendon Aerodrome car park, which fortunately means the war was now on, was empty. And the pilot was a little engine mechanic called Virgilio, an Italian. I don't know what he's doing there, but the fact remains he was training to be a pilot. And very excitable lad. Suddenly one of the chains cracked, and we were all standing just almost below it, and we had it go. And sure enough, the plane just did a complete flat spin of about one turn and dropped like a pancake right in the middle of the car park and broke nothing. Didn't even hurt Virgilio, but the funniest thing was, on the way down, he stood up in his seat and screamed the most beautifully cosmopolitan cuss I've ever heard. He stood up and screamed out, "Tonnerre de Dieu, go blimey!" And I thought for an Italian that was brilliant. And everybody collapsed in heaps there and then went up to have a look at the plane. There was nothing wrong with it. So she was very good as far as that was concerned.
Now, about the end of October or so in 1914, after you'd spent some weeks flying as a civilian trainee with Beatty, you joined the Naval Air Service proper. Could you describe the effect which this had on your life? How did it change it?
Well, for the moment, not a great deal. All that happened was the Admiralty accepted me, told me to get a pass the medical test and all that, and get a working kit of uniform. The only thing I remember about that medical test was filling in a form, and a very nice commander at the Admiralty came to a bit on the form marked religion. I wasn't quite sure what to put, so I just wrote Christian, and he grinned and said, "All Her Majesty's officers of His Majesty's Navy are supposed to be that." He said, "You're supposed to put down the sort of particular sect you belong to." And I said, "Oh, yes, no." So I made it Church of Scotland. I can still, it's the only thing I remember about that particular medical examination. I was probably flattering myself anyway. Yeah. But that was the getting in, wasn't very complex. But
then you continued
Yes, just the thing is that Hendon Aerodrome itself had been taken over. It belonged to Claude Graham White's company as a sort of aerodrome for, you know, flying for the public. It was a very successful show before the war, and he had his own flying school there. Well, the Admiralty took over the aerodrome and Graham White's flying school and made him a kind of honorary flight commander. He's a very good pilot, so I didn't see him very much. And they allowed Beatty, and there was one other small training school with some Caudron biplanes to remain on. I forget the name of the people that had it, on condition that they trained people who would eventually go into one of the services. So I just carried on with Beatty. Several others have been doing the same thing.
How much flying had you had at this point?
Oh, it was difficult. They didn't keep logs in those days. It was only a matter of a few hours. And it was all dual. Mm. All dual control. Beatty wasn't going to risk his sacred right biplane solo until you were ready for your certificate. People didn't realise at that time you took your certificate on your first solo. But so it worked very well. I did get some extra practice with the other small school because the Caudron biplane had an engine in front, which meant it was a tractor, slightly different to fly, and it was very useful to have some tractor experience later on. We had one milding. That was my first, bar busting my propeller up in Scotland, that was my first very mild crash on the Caudron. We were flying out just a bit beyond the Midland Railway line, which runs from St Pancras to the north, just beyond the railway line, and the engine cut completely. I found out later the tank was empty, but that wasn't my fault, because I was supposed to be the pupil. And So the pilot's name was Jimmy James, grabbed his control stick and immediately put our nose down because the Codron biplane had a gliding angle like a brick, started pointing us straight for the drone. But there was rather a toss-up whether we'd clear the railway line. At that moment, there were two express trains coming, one heading for Scotland, the other heading for St Pancras, I think. Yes, at St Pancras. It was a bit of a toss-up which we'd arrive at. Now, we just managed to jerk her up through the smoke, got over the railway line, and by the time we reached the field on the other side, she'd stalled at a height of about 5 or 6 feet up, and so the Codron did its normal neat little dive and turned upside down with its wheels in the air. It was a sort of conventional way for Codrons to land. It didn't do much harm to the plane. Then we both tumbled out and undid our belts and tumbled out of our seats, and nobody was any the worse, but it felt quite terrific.
I take it that there was nothing distinct between the training you were receiving now as a member of the Naval Air Service as compared with the flying you were receiving before this time as a strictly civilian training.
Oh, no, no. It was exactly
there wasn't it. Naval piloting as something distinct from
piloting.
No,
it was purely to fly. The training was... The Naval CO, was Commander Port, I think, was keeping his eye on the two civilian schools as well. They had to take their orders from him. It was just saved the Admiralty the trouble of taking them over as well. It was quite a cheap way of doing it. I think, if I remember rightly, they refunded our tuition fees later on, but I expect they did. And
could you describe for me, very difficult, I know, casting your mind back more than half a century, but could you describe for me whether you recollect there was any feeling at that time, we're talking about the autumn of 1914, of the Naval Air Service being, in any sense, a specialist unit, a corps d'élite? Was its own esprit de corps developing as early as this? Or were you just regarding yourselves as sailors? And
oh, no, it was very definitely, well, to use your own rather ornamental word, it was very much a corps d'élite. We knew it and we didn't care who else knew it. It definitely was. I remember Murray Souter, who was then the director of the Air Department at the Admiralty, addressing us, said, gentlemen, I expect the RNAS to combine the handiness of the Royal Navy with the smartness of the Brigade of Guards.
What was the occasion on which he addressed you in this way?
Just a pep talk, I should think.
I see.
In the mess at Hendon.
Yes. And what about the concept of pioneering a new service? Was that very strongly felt?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I think so. I think so.
To what extent do you think at the time you were conscious of pioneering a new service?
Well, if you want the honest truth, I think it was the case of we knew we were the best and we meant to remain that way. That was just the feeling in me. Shooting a lion nowadays, that's just exactly how we felt. And we did.
Why did you choose to join the Naval Air Service rather than the Military Air Service?
Because I never had any soldierly outlook at all. Never been the military type.
It occurred to me that, you know, if the main motivation was that you wanted to fly rather than join the Army or the Navy, you might have been rather indifferent to which service you joined.
Well, you must remember, flying was the main thing, and as a Western Islesman, the salt water's in our blood. So,
okay. Can I lead you on now to the actual going solo? When did you lead me up to the time when you took your ticket and describe the solo flight for me?
Well, Beatty had his own methods of training, which were very careful. He didn't want to have his plane crashed, and they sound pretty appalling nowadays, but his system was to give you concentrated dual control until he reckoned you were ready to take your pilot's ticket, and then he turned you loose solo, and you took your ticket on your first solos. And it sounds frightful, but it worked rather well. And generally speaking, he didn't have his plane damaged very often. Unfortunately, He did have it damaged all badly in the middle of December. I think it was the middle of December, 1914. And that put paid to my hopes of taking... I was ready for my ticket. I was due to go for it. And that put paid to my hopes of taking it in December, which I was really keen to do because it would have put me well inside the first 1,000 pilots, British pilots. And there was just no plane available to take it on. So it meant hanging about over Christmas while she was repaired. Fortunately, well, I was able to get leave over Christmas and New Year from the naval CO and got home to Scotland for Christmas and New Year, which was really delightful. But the fact remains, it was causing a nasty delay, putting me right into January. And it was well into January before the plane was repaired and weather was bad. With the result is, I didn't actually go for my pilot's ticket until the 30th of January 1915. Managed to take it all right. And my number is, if I remember rightly, 1061, just 61 over the 1,000. And it was most annoying because I'd have been well under the 1,000 if it hadn't been for that crash.
Hmm. Going on to the solo itself, could you describe for me, in as much detail as you can, the various stages that were involved in this test?
It wasn't badly worked out. What you did, you took the plane off and you made 5 figures of 8 covering the entire airfield, which meant you wouldn't get very high, probably a matter of about 150 feet or so, but it did make sure that you could do both left and right-hand turns and keep her within a certain, more or less around what were called the pylons, which marked the edge of the aerodrome. And after you'd done your 5 figures of 8, you had to bring her into the centre of the airfield and land her and come to rest within a given distance of a mark, which was the test inspector's oilskin coat. And it was really quite a good test. Then you went up again and did another series of 5 figures of 8 and made another landing, stopping within the specified distance. I forget what the distance was. And having done that, your test was now 2/3 complete. And then they tied an altimeter onto the passenger seat so that you know what height she was going to, with instructions to take her up to 500 feet, which seemed a colossal height. And having reached 500 feet, you were then supposed to do a vol plané descent, which meant with the engine totally cut off, which was quite tricky on the right because you had to push her nose well down with the engine full on before you dared switch it off, otherwise you would just stall and fall out of the sky. However, you got the nose down into a nice dive, just slightly above 500 feet, shut the engine off and kept it shut off. And then you had to land her without touching the engine again within the specified distance of the mark. And it all went according to plan because the inspector that night was a very well-known pilot called Merriam, F.W. Merriam, who signed my form. And I was now what was called a pilote aviateur because the certificates then were issued by the Fédération Aéronautique International.
Good. As far as you can recollect, was the instruction you were given at Hendon carried out entirely by civilian instructors, or were there any naval instructors taking part in your training as well?
Well, it's difficult to answer the whole question. I mean, my own instruction was purely by Beatty and the Codron people. As regards the Graham White School, I know they had one or two civilian instructors, and they may have had an odd naval pilot. I seem to remember the famous Sidney Pickles, who became quite famous, and Harry Hawker coming along. No, Harry Hawker was a civilian pilot doing a bit of instructing, but I think it was more or less just for showing the boys how. and one or two senior naval pilots, I think, probably gave a little instruction, but I don't just remember because they were a bit busy at Dunkirk and the coastal stations by that time.
Were there any parts of your flying training up to this stage when you took your certificate that had a specifically naval orientation?
Oh, well, elementary way. I mean, it was port and starboard, not left and right and so on. Things like that, but that's more or less you might call traditional or superficial. But as regards, you're speaking of sort of operational flying, what we were really learning to do was fly, because even up to the end of 1914, there was no such thing really as military aviation or naval aviation. Neither the Army or the Navy had learned how to use aircraft. They were only just beginning to find out. And we were more or less trying to teach them how useful we could be. And it took some people an awful long time to learn.
The Navy, I suppose, longer than the Army, grasps rather difficultly at a specific naval
application. Oh, I think at the present moment you'd better switch off the tape recorder. David Beatty was the first man that knew.